From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Seth Meyers has had a career that any comedian in America would kill for. He did improv for a few years before landing a spot on Saturday Night Live. And on the show, Meyers was a sketch performer, a writer, then head writer, and he hosted SNL's Weekend Update along with Amy Poehler. Eventually, NBC gave him a show of his own, Late Night with Seth Meyers. In 2017, staff writer Ariel Levy sat down with Meyers at the New Yorker Festival, and she began, always a good place to start, at the beginning.
I happen to know that the person who most inspired him to become a comedian, the funniest person you know, is your dad.
Yes.
Yes. So tell us about his sense of humor. Give us a sense of the humor that...
Well, I will say my father, who is in finance, is the funniest person not only I know, but I feel like he's been the funniest person in any office he's ever worked in. My dad gives away tickets to my show pretty much all the time. Like, my dad could bump into someone at a restaurant and will apologize for bumping into them, and it will end with those people getting tickets to my show. But a lot of times, people from the bank that he works at will come to the show, and they will say to me, "The show was so funny tonight. You're not as funny as your dad." Like, even they want to tell me. Which, on an esteem level, isn't great, but I do agree with them.
But yeah. It's true.
Yeah,
it's
and my dad, I will say, at a very age-inappropriate time, introduced my brother and I to Monty Python, SNL, Richard Pryor. I feel like we were probably the only 11-year-olds who were listening to Richard Pryor. If you haven't, a lot of words that aren't for 11-year-olds in those early Richard Pryor albums, so that was his taste.
Is there a your dad joke that's like a classic of the genre?
No, my dad's a storyteller. He's not a joke guy. This, I will tell a brief story about my dad. I don't know if this is really about how funny my dad is, but it is about how crazy my dad is. My dad feels very strongly about justice and being right, and he has a little bit of a temper. We grew up in New Hampshire. If you've ever been to New Hampshire, a lot of trees. There we go, live free or die. And my dad had wanted us to have a backyard, and we just had like basically woods. So we had all these trees cut down, but then we had stumps in the backyard. And my dad was trying to figure out how to get rid of the stumps. And there was someone else in the neighborhood who was having work done, and there was basically a machine that would get rid of stumps. Anyway, we drove by, and my dad said to these guys, "Hey, will you come and remove these stumps?" And they said, "Yeah, sure, we'll do it tomorrow." And then they didn't. And so the next day, we're driving to school, my brother and I in the back seat, and my dad stopped and said, "Hey, you said you were gonna do it. Will you do it tomorrow?" And they said, "Absolutely," and then they didn't do it. And then the third day, it took 3 days for my dad to do this, he stopped the car, he parked it next to these trucks and said to my brother and I, he looked back in the back seat and said, "It'll be fine," which is a terrifying thing to hear. And then he got out in his business suit and he laid down in front of one of their trucks. And these guys walked over and said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I would rather die than have these stumps in my backyard another day." And so they said, "Hey man," because again, they didn't know him well enough to not think he wasn't crazy. And they said, "We will take care of this tomorrow." And then my dad got back in the car and we were driving to school. And my brother said, "Why would you do that with us in the car?" And my dad said, "It wouldn't have worked without you in the car." That tells you a lot about my dad.
Your mom is, of course, Madame Meyers.
She was a famous French teacher.
Famous French teacher who helped you to cut school all the time. Why did she do that?
My mom really liked hanging out with my brother and I. If we even hinted that we had a tickle of something in our throat, she would not only let us stay home, she would then also stay home. My mom retired after 25 years as a school teacher, I'm pretty sure with zero sick days left on her. She would just, like, then she would go to a video store and rent movies, and we would just hang out with her all the time. She was, she continues to be an incredible mom.
And then you went to Northwestern, which
I did.
A good school, so you must have gone to high school sometimes.
I did.
Cut.
Yeah.
And then when you went to Chicago, obviously there's a famous comedy scene there.
Yeah.
Were you immediately super involved in it? And did you know any of your future SNL cast members when you were in Chicago?
Yeah, so I was a radio, TV, film painter. I was a film major. That was my plan when I went to Northwestern. And I realized right away that great filmmakers have to have an incredible amount of patience, which I don't feel as though I have. And there was also an improv troupe at Northwestern, and I saw that, and I think improvisers have no patience at all. It's the perfect thing. If you have no patience and you don't want to prepare for anything, basically improv is for you.
It's your jam.
So I immediately started going, taking improv classes in Chicago and falling in love with that. I remember seeing one of the most informative moments of my young comedy career is I went to a show one night, and it was Amy Poehler and Tina Fey were doing a two-person show in Chicago, and the show was called Women of Color.
And the color white?
They did it one time before Amy left to move to New York and start UCB. So I saw the only performance of that show and was blown away.
And then you went to Amsterdam. Why did you do that?
It's important when people hear you went to Amsterdam that you point out that you had a reason. Other than that's where weed is legal. But two Chicago guys started a Second City style improv theater in Amsterdam. And they would have auditions in Chicago for it. And so I auditioned for and got hired to work full time at an improv comedy theater in Amsterdam, which was the best 2 years of my life. And then that was where I met a lot of people that I continued to work with over the years. Jason Sudeikis from SNL was out there. Kate Cannon, who wrote the movie Pitch Perfect. Jordan Peele from Key and Peele was out there when I was there. So it was really exciting. Ike Barinholtz, who's on the Mindy Project. But there was a lot of really cool people who were out there at the same time.
And how do you get from there to SNL?
So I come back from Amsterdam, and I met a fellow comedian out there named Jill Benjamin. We came back to Chicago, and we started doing a two-person show in Chicago called Pickups and Hiccups. Wasn't great. And that show we did a lot in Chicago. We did it at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. We did it in London. We did it at the Singapore Comedy Festival. And then we were randomly doing it one night in Chicago, and a talent scout from SNL saw it, and that started the process.
And then the process is what? Is make us a tape.
So it was so hard to make a tape, guys. I should have gotten hired just on the fact that I made a tape. A friend of mine sent it to me recently. I could only watch about 15 seconds of it before I was terrified and just started to sweat with like residual memory of how fear, like the fear. But it was one of those things, a tiny camera. I was standing in front of his like chest of drawers, and it was one of those little tapes that then you had to put into a VHS tape. It was a nightmare. But I sent that in. 6 months later, they asked for a second tape, and then about 6 months after that, I auditioned.
And then you immediately got hired as a performer.
Yes.
Okay, so let's see you performing early on.
Oh, no.
Yeah, let's.
Oh, no.
No, it's funny. Let's see the first clip, which is March Madness.
I don't like this. I don't like being a
spitter. You're going to like it.
I really don't like this. I'm very upset. Now I know what it is.
No, you're going to love it.
Ugh.
Here's the winner of this year's SNL Office Pool, Seth Meyers.
Well, hello. Hello, Judy and Tina. Or should I say hello? Losers!
Congratulations, Seth. You did a good job.
Yeah, what's that, Jimmy? I can't hear you all the way up here at the top. Ah, the sweet nectar of success.
Stop doing that.
Delicious!
Seth, why do you have to act like this?
Well, I'd like to tell you, Tina, but anyone stupid enough to think Kentucky was going to win the tournament wouldn't understand. Duh, duh, duh. I'm Tina Fey. No one can beat Kentucky.
Come on, just a pool, man. Just a pool.
What's that? I can't hear you, Fallon. The rustle of your $10 bill is deafening. With money like this, the options are endless. Yay! 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 Yay!
You know, there are only 15 of us. You do realize you only won $150.
No, I did not realize that. In my excitement, I seem to have shanked my math pretty badly and added a 0 or 3 to my winnings. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have a plasma TV and a cheetah to unbuy. A good day to you. Oh.
Seth Meyers, everybody. Seth Meyers.
Okay. I do want to point out that as a sketch performer on the show, what ultimately happened is Lauren Michaels decided, you know what you would be good at? Sitting behind a desk as yourself. So that was genuinely not enjoyable for me to watch.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It was, you know, I think I have to face it.
Tonight's the night.
Tonight's the night, yeah.
Then you become a writer.
Yeah.
Tell us about the difference between working there as a performer and a writer.
Well, as a performer can be a little bit lonelier in that all performers at SNL are expected to write, but if you have a week where none of your stuff gets picked, you then kind of become obviously less vital to the process, and there would be Thursdays where nothing, you weren't in any of the sketches that were rehearsing and you would just stay home all day. And it sounds awesome to have a Thursday off unless it means that you have it off because you failed, in which case it's not great. But as a writer on the show, even if you didn't get anything on, you would go to a rewrite table, you'd spend all day with writers, you'd try to, you know, add value by suggesting jokes. And so I really enjoyed that. I like being in rooms with writers, I still do. And it was the first time, when I became a writer on the show, it was the first time that I thought, oh, I'm above average at this. I feel like the show's been carrying me, and now I can finally hopefully give something back of value to thank them for keeping me around.
I'm imagining that hosting Weekend Update was really good preparation for having your own show.
Yes. The nice thing for me about Weekend Update was, for the first time, you just got to be yourself as opposed to playing characters. And right. And again, there are some people at SNL, you know, I worked with people like Kristen Wiig or Bill Hader or Fred Armisen, who put on a wig and completely transform into another human being. Whereas I always just looked like a guy in a wig. So I was very happy doing things like that. It was also, I was really lucky to be doing it with my best friend on the show, who was Amy. And so I felt immediately comfortable. She had done it with Tina, and I came in to fill in once Tina left. So Amy was a pro at that point, and that was a great amount of comfort for me. And yeah, it was basically just, again, what my show is now, which is just sitting at a desk and telling jokes. The more you do it, the more reps you have, the better you're gonna get at it. And so I was really lucky to do it at SNL. Plus, the difference now is, you know, our show is live to tape, but it's not live. So I will never feel as nervous doing my show as I did doing SNL, even when I did it for 13 years.
So in the midst of that, which is the most stressful job you've ever had, you met your wife.
Yeah.
We were talking about this before, who's like the star of a rom-com. Like, she's a human rights lawyer who looks like a movie star.
Yeah.
So how did you guys meet, and how did you start a relationship while you were doing the hardest job of your life?
I met her at a wedding. I met her at Chris Kattan's wedding. We sat next to each other the second night of the wedding, and people were asking us how long we'd been a couple. Like, we genuinely, like, had that chemistry from the beginning. But my wife was a prosecutor at the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office. She prosecuted sex crimes. And this is how impossible I am to live with. I would be the one in a bad mood at the end of the day. Like, I'd come home if my monologue was bad and just, like, throw myself down on the couch. She'd say, what's wrong? And I would say, I have 2 jokes didn't work. And then, like, an hour later, I'd ask her how her day was, and she'd say, really rough. We put a pimp in jail. I'd be like, Anyways, I don't know why those jokes didn't work, so.
And did you watch late night shows a lot? Like, did you, let's put it this way. Did you have a vision of having a show like this?
No, I had a vision. My dream was always SNL.
Yeah.
And once I was on SNL, my dream was Weekend Update. I did not think much past it. And I watched Letterman in high school. I watched Conan in college.
Yeah.
But SNL was really the show that was the biggest influence on me.
Uh-huh.
And I never thought that this would be something I'd end up doing.
And so tell us about what it was like when this ended up happening.
Well, Lorne, the thing about Lorne Michaels is he's, every conversation you have with Lorne, it feels like a follow-up conversation to a conversation that never happened. So he's talking about details that you don't have. I remember I was doing stand-up somewhere in Ohio, and the New York Post had written an article saying that Jimmy was going to take over for Leno and I was going to take over for Jimmy. And I just assumed it was a rumor. And Lorne called me in Ohio and he said, look, you know, I think you'll be good at it. And over time, you'll find your footing and it'll be good. And I was like, what is happening right now? And it was, so my memory of being offered the job was taking 3 days to realize that I had been offered the job. Which also happened when I got hired for SNL. I had a really just cryptic meeting with Lorne. I had auditioned and he brought me in to meet him. And I just remember he said, at one point he said, so obviously we're gonna wanna see how you look in wigs. And so I assumed there was this wig test I had to pass. And then years later I mentioned it to someone and they said, we never do a wig test. And I was like, why would he say that? And I got hired at the same time as someone else. And I remember that person and I met up for drinks afterwards because we had flown out together. And he walked in and said, I got hired. And I was heartbroken because I figured if he got hired, that meant I didn't. And it wasn't until 4 days later that I realized I got hired. And I just was more pessimistic than this other person who just assumed he would nail the wig test when the time came.
And so SNL was like this huge goal. And you've accomplished so much. It sounds like you've accomplished more than you meant to.
Oh, this is all going way better than I thought it would. Yeah.
Okay.
If you take away anything, don't be that I was like, I feel like I'm about 75% of what I deserve. Yeah, this is beyond my wildest dreams.
This is beyond your wildest
dreams. Yeah.
We were lucky enough to have your friend Amy Poehler here a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I asked her, are you surprised? Like, did you envision all this? And she said, yeah.
Yeah.
This was the plan. You, no.
No, but that was the great thing about being friends with Poehler, is Poehler was this confidence wave that you could just kind of coast off. She was the person on the Tour de France team that was in the front, just like biking against the wind, saying like, I'm gonna win this fucking yellow jacket. And the rest of us were just behind her saying, this is great. I love being behind this person who's so sure. Now, by the way, I should also point out, I also expected it all for Poehler as well.
Right.
You know, she's Poehler. Of course, she should think it was going to happen for her. I just, yeah, I had less confidence about it. And, you know, over time, it was just really important to find what my lane was and get better at a few things as opposed to try to be everything. I think that's one of the problems when you show up at SNL, is you kind of think, oh, I'll be all the things. And then
right.
Over time you realize, or maybe just one or two of the things and get really good at that.
But you have been all the things. Like, you've done lots of stand-up.
Yeah, I do stand-up. I like doing stand-up. But this, I feel like this that I'm doing right now feels the closest to what I was meant to be doing. And that's a really nice thing. I mean, I think a lot of people end up doing jobs and thinking about if only I was doing that,
right?
I'd be crushing it. Like, there's no one else I look at now. And I think early in SNL, you tend to sort of compare and despair based on what other people are doing. And this is the first time that I've thought, there's nothing else happening in show business right now that I'd rather be doing than this.
That's fantastic.
It's great. It took a long time to get there, but it's really, I'm really happy about it.
Seth Meyers appearing with Aria Levy at the New Yorker Festival. And in a minute, Seth talks about doing SNL with no less a guest star than Donald Trump. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Every October, the New Yorker throws a festival of live events bringing our writers together with the biggest names in politics and culture and entertainment. In 2017, staff writer Aria Levy spoke with Seth Meyers, the host of NBC's Late Night and a longtime veteran of Saturday Night Live.
Okay, so during your time at SNL, you also started another very significant relationship in your life. with a reality television star named Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Tell us about your impression of him when he hosted.
So he hosted, I think, in 2004, 2005. And he was a lovable buffoon, is right. The only way to put it. There was nothing scary about him. He was just kind of a big old dope who had no sense of humor, but would say the words you put in front of him, and it was kind of fun. Like, oh, this is a human who will do things you ask him to. We ended up doing, we did a sketch together where he played my dad. We did a sketch called Donald Trump's House.
You wear a wig.
I wore a wig that looked like him. It's very eerie now.
Hi, welcome to Fathers and Sons, the show that teaches and discusses how positive communication between fathers and sons can make this special relationship between two men even better. I'm Peter Fleck, and this is my dad, Gary. There's no reason why sensitivity and warmth can't be key ingredients between fathers and sons. That's why we're here today on Fathers and Sons. Isn't that right, Dad?
You could really cut that intro in half. Boy, it's way, way too long.
Okay, here we go again. All right. It's a bit long. You're right.
You don't have to tell me when I'm right. I know when I'm right. Now, let's do it. Come on. This is just a miserable way to spend a Sunday.
Myself and a bunch of other people, including Amy Poehler, Mike Schur, who is a great showrunner now for The Good Place, who created Parks and Rec as well, wrote a sketch called Donald Trump's House of Wings, where he basically talked about opening a chicken wing restaurant.
Can you do this song?
Yeah, well, it was to the Pointer Sisters' Jump. It was, so he would talk about his chicken wing place, and he was wearing like a yellow suit. And then we would come out, me, Maya, Keenan, and Amy in chicken eggs, like egg, chicks coming out of eggs. And it was, Trump, you know these wings will make you happy. Trump in, you know these wings will fill you up. Trump, if you want blue cheese, it'll be a dollar extra. Donald Trump's House of Wings. It's really fun. And it was really great, thank you. He didn't until, and this is very, this is the, looking back is the most haunting part of it. He had no sense of humor, or I shouldn't say, like, I don't mean to say he was humorless. He didn't know what was funny until an audience told him. And so he thought that sketch was so dumb. And then we did it, and the audience, like, there was, like, an applause break, and you just watch him light up. And then he starts dancing, yep. And he just go, and you just realize in the same way that he, like, became a candidate based on audience reaction, like that, oh, whoa, wall works, I'll do wall. Tonight I'm going to do wall. Wall is a big pit. And so he's just that. He just chases where the laughs are and where the reaction is. And so that was, looking back, that was the weird part.
Let's watch something from when the idea that he'd still control the free world was funny. This is Seth doing the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Can we see the clip from the Correspondents' Dinner, please?
And then, of course, there's Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke. Donald Trump often appears on Fox, which is ironic because a fox often appears on Donald Trump's head. If you're at the Washington Post table with Trump and you can't finish your entree, don't worry, the fox will eat it. And if I can for a moment talk about the birther issue, when did we get so suspicious about where people were born? A USA Today poll last week said 38% of Americans think the president was definitely born in the US. In the same poll, in the very same poll, only 5% more said Donald Trump was definitely born in the US. Has it reached the point where Americans only think someone was born here if they saw it? I know I was born here, and I know my younger brother was born here. But when it comes to my older brother, I can only take him at his word. Gary Busey said recently that Donald Trump would make a great president. Of course, he said the same thing about an old rusty birdcage he found. Donald Trump owns the Miss USA pageant, which is great for Republicans because it will streamline their search for a vice president. Donald Trump said recently he has a great relationship with the blacks, though unless the blacks are a family of white people, I bet he's mistaken.
Trippy.
So, Donald Trump looks like he wants to eat your liver with a nice Chianti. So, did you feel fear the next time you saw him?
So, a couple things. One, I could not see him. That room, it's like, it would be like right now seeing if somebody here, you can't see the faces. And I walked off stage that night and I got a call from Al Franken, who I had talked to ahead of time about that night, because he had actually hosted it twice. And he called and he said, you did a great job. If you see Donald Trump, run away. I saw him like 3 days later in New York at an event. And I had this real moment. And I do feel like this is something that Lorne Michaels tries to instill in you when you work on the show. Like, don't write a joke about somebody that you feel is so unfair and so out of bounds that if you saw them, you would be ashamed to see them. I felt like everything I wrote that night was totally in bounds because, again, you know, this was the height of him saying the president wasn't burned here, which is, you know, really the root of where we are today. And so I walked over to him with, like, a big old grin on my face. And I said, hey, I want to thank you for being such a good sport the other night, even though he had not been a good sport. And he had not been a good sport afterwards and had sort of gone on Fox and Friends and talked about what a terrible job I did. And I gave him the opportunity to be cool about it. And in front of a bunch of people, he didn't take that opportunity. He said something along the lines of, you were too rough. The president was funny, but you were too rough. You crossed the line. You were too rough. And then I said, well, thanks anyway, and walked away. And then I felt just like sweat. Because again, the other thing is just a big guy. You forget, he's kind of like just like a big, it's like a bear. Like a circus bear that just figured out how to walk and is just working through motor skills. But it was, the other thing though I should say is, a lot was written in the run-up to this election. There was even a piece in The New Yorker, I can't remember who wrote it, I wish I could, about how that night was what set
right,
him on
thing. Right.
And some of those articles would mention me, but some of them, The New Yorker included, left me out and said the reason Trump is running is because Obama made fun of him that night.
Right.
And that always made me really angry because I wanted to share credit for tricking... I helped trick an unelectable person to run for president.
Except for one thing.
And then he won. And when he won, my first thought was, this is Obama's fault. I had nothing to do with this.
It was a wonderful night. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it.
Seth Meyers, host of Late Night, talking with New Yorker staff writer Aria Levy at the New Yorker Festival in 2017. You can find all of Aria's writing for us at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. I'm David Remnick. Edwin Raymond is a New York City police sergeant and also a plaintiff in a lawsuit brought by 12 officers against the NYPD. In an organization that respects the so-called blue wall of silence, Raymond and his colleagues have gone public at real risk to themselves with allegations of racial bias in policing. Sergeant Raymond talks with Jennifer Gonerman, who covers criminal justice for The New Yorker, next time on The New Yorker Radio Hour. This week, we're bringing you some of the highlights from the New Yorker Festival. In 2016, as the notion of what is or isn't presidential conduct came to the fore in the election, Michael Shulman spoke with three notable actors about what it means to act the part, to be presidential. He was joined by Alfre Woodard, the star of NBC's political drama State of Affairs, Tony Goldwyn of ABC's Scandal, and Bill Pullman, who rallied Earth to join forces in Independence Day.
Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Shulman from The New Yorker, and welcome to the 17th Annual New Yorker Festival and to today's panel, Commanders-in-Chief. And without further ado, please join me in welcoming President Constance Peyton, President Fitzgerald Grant III, and President Thomas J. Whitmore. Also known as Alfre Woodard, Tony Goldwyn, and Bill Pullman.
You're welcome.
You have all had incredibly rich, long careers where you've played many characters, but you're here today because at some point you have memorably played the President of the United States. And so my first question is there something categorically different about playing the President than any other part you've done? In other words, you know, did you just approach this as a human being like any other, with their own behavior, motivations, et cetera, or was there something that really set this job apart by definition?
That's the interesting thing about the presidency. The person comes into it. You don't change anything into anything else. It makes me laugh when people talk about being presidential. That just means keep your fingers out of your nose or something. But, but whoever you are, it's like going to your job. You know what your job requirement is in the day, and you bring your whole history of who you are and the way you relate to people and your mores with it. Mm-hmm.
For me, the thing that struck me as most different was in playing the president, every minute of every day, the stakes involved in everything that you do are so incredibly high. So that even if you're just, you know, going through something that's rather routine, what's going on behind the curtain is heightened all the time, 24/7, even in walking down the hallway. Hmm.
Well, I came mostly to hear what other president actors had to say. So I don't know, there was just something, such a giggle to be able to, after people talking to you, what it's like to be the president. You want to hear what other actors have to say about it. Because when I first heard about the Independence Day in 1995, they said, and they're thinking about you as the president of the United States. And I said, oh, it's a comedy. I had really seriously thought, no, it's a serious part. And I think at that point, 95, up until then, the president's part wasn't a desirable part. I remember a lot of TV series where you'd only see the back of his head, or a movie, the president's coming and he passed quickly so you didn't get to know him, or if he was a lesser part. But to think of a crafted character that's a central character and you're watching the nuances of his psychology and everything, that was fairly new in 95. And since then, it seems to be a character type like Hamlet that everybody wants to take a whack at. Hmm.
What does that word presidential mean to you? Is it something you felt like you had to draw in as an actor or think about? Is there a physicality to it that you saw yourself taking on?
I remember just that one thing that I was talked to the Roland Emmerich when we first were doing it was that, you know, that I didn't want to have to work hard at being president. That I thought a lot of it would be him directing everybody else, that no matter what they said, they had to triangulate to me. You know, that there, if there's a discussion between two people in the room I'm in, I want to be clocked, you know? Because that feels like that would be what would happen with a president. And it wasn't my assertion of anything that would make that happen. It had to be something in the air that we all agreed is part of what it is to be presidential. Is you don't get to, you know, leave him out of the conversation. I don't know, but maybe he did.
I think that's really true. And that's what sort of struck me. It made me laugh all the time, because even though I'm playing the president, people treat me differently. Like all of a sudden you just come into the room and people, you have all of this gravitas by definition. So everybody is always looking at you all the time, 24/7. You are in the public eye. So how do you handle that?
Was I one of the first women presidents? Did I play one of the first women presidents?
I mean, well, it's an interesting topic. I mean, we've had Cherry Jones on 24, Gina Davis on Commanders in Chief. It's sort of become a bit more of a trope.
But I ask because I forget. Gina's a good friend, so yes, I do know that. But there is a different awareness coming in it as a woman. Mm. So I was aware of the fact that as a culture, we had this mommy thing where somehow we turn everything over to the moms of the country, and everybody, even as adults, are still feeding at the breast of the mom, the big country mom. This is getting a little risque, but go for it. But we still couldn't bring ourselves to say Madam President. We don't know what would happen if you had to say that. So I felt responsibility to make sure that she was somebody, first of all, realistically, figuring out how it would happen after the first African-American president, mm-hmm. that there would be another African-American president. So for me, I just can't act whatever somebody wanted to have. I've got to know where I came from. So Jill Carnahan and I came up with a backstory for Constance Payton, and it was that she was a combat veteran. Mm-hmm. So she's military, so that automatically gives me a certain amount of bearing and a certain balance and sort of playing it close to the vest and practical conservatism in terms of how I deal with people.
Yeah.
So I had two things going, being a woman and not wanting to cut up so they start saying, oh yes, see, they put a skirt in there and everything goes to hell. The other was that I was my military background and how I came up through, even to be, you have to walk it up. How does a woman get to be the commander in chief? And it has to make sense. You may not even know any of backstories, but you'll know whether you believe something or not. And that's when an actor has done their homework from that person, mm-hmm. as a kid, because anybody that runs for president has known that they could do it from the time they were 8. Mm. They might become the president of something else, but you don't just suddenly say, you know what, damn it, I'm going to run for president.
You know, it's funny, I didn't think about this before this moment, but you all play military veterans who are presidents, which is funny because we haven't had that recently. Mm. It just struck me that's a storyline that is common to all of you. I don't know if that informed the character for you guys as well.
Yeah, I think it's the military thing I know was very important for Independence Day, that first movie, because there was a lot of question about Bill Clinton and whether he could be tough, you know, being more liberal and everything else. And so they made a deliberate choice to have this fighter pilot background and, you know, the scene of the president in, you know, getting back into uniform and, you know, appearing before the troops on the aircraft carrier before. And then it was so curious to later see Bush in a flight uniform saying, we have won in Iraq, in the very complete kind of replication of this same thing that we had done in the movie.
Well, this is a great moment to pause, and we should watch our clip from Independence Day, which is a scene that became absolutely iconic. So let's watch Bill Pullman in the original Independence Day in 1996.
In less than an hour, aircraft from here will join others from around the world. And you will be launching the largest aerial battle in the history of mankind. Mankind, that word should have new meaning for all of us today. We can't be consumed by our petty differences anymore. We will be united in our common interest. Perhaps it's fate that today is the 4th of July, and you will once again be fighting for our freedom. Not from tyranny, oppression, or persecution, but from annihilation. We're fighting for our right to live, to exist. And should we win the day, the 4th of July will no longer be known as an American holiday, but as the day when the world declared in one voice, we will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish without a fight. We're going to live on. We're going to survive. Today, we celebrate our Independence Day.
All right. So I have to say, before I went and rewatched the movie, not having seen it since it was in the theater in 1996, I remembered that speech as an address to the nation, and it's actually not. It's him just talking to these troops. But I think that's because it feels like that actually happened. Like, it just, you know what I mean? Like, people really, it really feels like that is, you know, part of the pantheon of, you know, presidential speech making. And how did you psych yourself up for this? I mean, did you read any presidential oratory or anything that drew from real life?
Well, I did. At that point, there wasn't the internet, and I was remembering, and I finally got a CD of the recording that Robert Kennedy speech that he gave upon hearing about Martin Luther King's death. And it's impromptu. And so I felt like that idea would be under great duress, you know, when the whole thing was looking very bad for not only us, but all of us, you know. It was, the speech that Kennedy gave was just 2 minutes after hearing of Martin Luther King's death. And he, you know, out of this calm center of him, spoke about that this is a time in which it is understandable for blacks to have bitterness and anger and revenge. And he could feel that that would be a legitimate response to this. But he quoted Aeschylus in talking about how the pain can drop one by drop, drop by drop, pain will drop on us in our sleep until we will begin to have greater wisdom for compassion and love by the awful grace of God, which I thought so amazing to have a guy who's running for president stand up. And then the capper was, he said, I understand your anger now because I too lost a member of my family not long ago, speaking of the assassination of JFK. And I thought all those ingredients were really, should be, you know, his own investment in the moment, his own understanding and compassion for everyone else's fear, you know, and to take that on and speak of it, I thought was good example to look at for that. Mm.
And then, as you mentioned, this, you know, this was 5 years before 9/11, and you know, when 9/11 happened, a lot of people said, oh, well, this is like a Roland Emmerich movie, this is like a Hollywood disaster movie. And then, you know, we would see George W. Bush give these speeches trying to rouse the nation and unite the world, and you know, and some of the imagery, like the mission accomplished moment, just, it's people, you know, more than one person observed this is kind of like Bill Pullman and Independence Day. Did you have that feeling of watching this, feeling like life was imitating art? I mean, what was that like for you to observe?
Yeah, I do feel like it's strange how when I do, I meet presidents, there is a little look in their eye like, you're one of us. But it is weird, you know, and I'll go to certain countries and they love the little theater of saying, Mr. President, you know.
Do you guys get that ever?
All the time.
Well, you have the reputation of being a buff president. I got to say, if I could change mine for yours, I think I'd go for that. Being, a real not feral, but But how is that? I mean, does that ever bug you? I mean, in some ways, it's part of the scandal thing is that you have a lure. Tony, come on. How does that fit? Does that sync right with you?
No, but it's, you never know. One week you're going to open your script and be like, oh, God, I have to have my clothes off again. It's a bit of a thing in Shondaland for the men of, yeah. As the president, you must be prepared.
To drop crown. All right, it's time to watch a scandal clip.
Please tell me I have my clothes on.
This is season 2 of Scandal. It's a flashback to the night of Fitz's inauguration. See, they know. Let's watch Tony Goldwyn in Scandal.
Mr. President.
Not like that. Say it again.
Mr. President.
Mm-hmm.
We can't.
We can't.
Look around you. Look where we are. This can't happen. Not anymore.
I think it could happen right there on that desk.
We decided we have to stop.
You're the most important person in my life. I can't just stop. Can you?
Very nice. Whoa.
I mean, Scandal has these incredible scenes of Olivia and Fitz, or as the internet calls them, Olitz, who have these electric, really steamy, intense scenes. Can you just tell us about what it's like to film those?
It's such a funny thing, you know, doing sex on camera. I mean, thank God Carrie and I have, we have a great friendship and a great mutual trust that we've found immediately. And I say that's important because it's a terribly awkward, weird thing, as these guys will tell you, you know, when you're, and it never isn't that, because, you know, people think it's so super hot, but imagine, just imagine having sex with 50 people standing there looking at you, you know, which is what a film crew is and does. And the antidote to that, in addition to, the connection you have with your fellow actor is the scene that you're playing and, you know, what's actually happening between the characters and their relationship. And that's what you focus on so that you don't have to think about this bizarre thing that you're doing in public.
I mean, do you think of Fitz as someone who uses his power as a kind of sexual...
No, I don't, personally. Some people might. I don't. And it was very important to me, as the character developed, to anchor it in someone who was desperately, uncontrollably in love with this woman and was willing to sacrifice all of it for her. Mm. And even in the realm of perhaps possible self-justification, in the first season of the show, when you first met Fitz, he was accused of having an affair with a staffer, which it turned out he ultimately did. So even in thinking about that character named Amanda Tanner, first of all, for a long time, Shonda didn't decide whether Fitz had slept with her or he hadn't. It was like 6 episodes in, and I kept asking her, did I do it or did I not? And she said, I don't know yet. And she said, I'll tell you when I know. So, but when it turned out that he had, I, for myself, I was like, and I think Fitz even said this, he did that out of, you know, a heartbreak over having lost Olivia, and he just did this stupid, impulsive, irresponsible thing, you know. But I guess my point is it was not a conscious abuse of power. You know, a lot of people might disagree with me or accuse Fitz of that 100%, but I don't see it that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that first season, the Amanda Tanner storyline where he sleeps with a White House intern, of course, made people think of
Clinton.
Monica, right.
I mean, did you, and I've read that you have borrowed, you know, looked at aspects of Bill Clinton. I mean, is that, can you tell us about what parts of him or other real presidents you looked at, or was it something where you had to consciously not draw too many parallels so that people...
No, I mean, look, the Monica Lewinsky thing, obviously, that's just out there. The only thing I was conscious of about that was just the differentness in scandal is, as I said, from Fitz, his obsessive love for Olivia Pope dominates all. He was terribly, completely in love with her. And that was just different than the situation with Bill Clinton.
Well, so let's watch a clip of Alfrey in State of Affairs. So this is the last episode, and she's in the Situation Room, President Constance Payton, and she is deciding whether to take out a really top-level terrorist.
Admiral McKay, this is the President. What's the travel time from ship to target?
Another half hour, Madam President.
The universe chose quite a night for all this.
How long before I have to speak at the correspondence dinner?
Less than an hour. We could postpone.
No, absolutely not. No one but the press, public, and God forbid our enemies can ever get a whiff of what's going on in this room. If we change anything now, it might compromise the mission.
Understood. Are you okay?
No, I'm fine. I have waited a damn long time for this moment.
And then David Harbour and I have sex.
So what can you tell us about this scene and how you crafted this character of President Payton?
How I crafted her? Well, I started knocking on doors. We called it walking precinct back in the day. With my parents when I was 10 years old. So I've been active in every presidential, municipal, state campaign. That's just what I do. So, and I've been around protesting, helping make the signs, being a body on the line, eventually by Ron Dellums, who was a congressman from Berkeley, who eventually was mayor of Oakland for a while, said, you know, you got to come into the building, meaning the Capitol. You got to come in if you want to affect policy instead of just storming the ramparts. And so I started to come in with other people to lobby for things that we thought were important for, women's issues, civil rights, equal rights, all of that thing. But I started to understand what it took to make things happen. Like I said, I was just tired of being over in that corner. So with Constance Payton, I would have worked for her when she ran for, when she came out of the military and she went for her law degree. I would have been volunteering for her. I had a great idea of who she was. But my work was to understand and be able to articulate and act out of a militaristic point of view, out of a conservative point of view, So because my impulse would be the other direction. But it was more of finding the human being, a human being that would have made choices that I didn't make, but not just find her reality. Because, I mean, that's our job always as an actor. We all have individual fingerprints. Out of the billions of people that have ever been born, none are alike. So what makes Constance Payton different from another 10,000 black women that look like her, talk like her, has had those same experience? That's what's so wonderful about it. You're constantly practicing, reaching for, refining, being able to speak out of that person's reality rather than your reality as an actor.
One thing that is so striking is that we've had a lot of female and minority presidents in fiction. Going back to Morgan Freeman and Deep Impact, Gina Davis and Commander in Chief.
Dennis Haysbert. Yeah.
Dennis Haysbert and Cherry Jones on 24. But this show was really groundbreaking in that it was the first popular culture representation that I can think of a black woman as president. What did that mean to you?
I don't think it meant to me what it probably meant to little girls watching it or little boys, because We owe our boys truthful representation. We owe our boys possibility as much as we owe our girls. We have to remember that they're watching too. And we're training their expectations the way that we train our girls' expectations. To me, I had a job to do. I'm not conscious ever when I'm playing a character. I'm not conscious of how that character's perceived. I can't be, because then I've stepped out of who that person is.
The actors Bill Pullman, Alfre Woodard, and Tony Goldwyn with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman in 2016. That's it for the show this week, and I hope you enjoyed it. Next time, Jennifer Gonerman talks with the NYPD whistleblower, Edwin Raymond. Till then, you can follow us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.